Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Sunday morning council workshop, the annual council workshop. And just to be to set the stage, we have 4 hours set aside for this discussion from 10 until 2. There are a number of topics that I think we need to cover, but suffice it to say, if we don't need the 4 hours, that's okay too. Most of you should hopefully be aware that at 4 o'clock we have our standard council prep meeting, where we actually talk about just the week ahead and make sure that we've covered off assignments of the various issues and other meetings that we that somebody from this council should be participating in. So depending on how the workshop goes, if we don't need all 4 hours, there's a possibility we could pull forward the council prep meeting into this time block. So I just want to put that out there for us to contemplate as we move through the morning and the early afternoon. In the first 2 hours, we'll be focused more on internal and administrative issues, CCNSO and council-specific issues, and in the back half of this scheduled meeting, we will focus on the two big-picture issues around the CWG and the CCWG, where we will have their respective chairs participate in the meeting to give us essentially a status, timelines, updates, and an opportunity for us to question them, provide some input and feedback, and just have a general exchange with the respective co-chairs of those two working groups. So that's the overall structure of, at a very high level, of the morning. If agreed, I'd like to put forward the agenda for the first half of this workshop. And that's around the work of the FOI working group to provide a status update, as well as some thoughts on discussions with the GAC and where we're at with the GAC. We will have our standard discussion around roles and responsibilities for the year going forward, how we've done in the past year and what we can do for the year going forward, so that we as a council can actually try to run as effectively as possible and distribute the workload and the effort in a reasonable way for us all, and talk about some of the other issues related to that. You know, should there be for standing committees a term limit? Should we try to roll over councillors in those groups to make sure that, again, the workload is fairly spread and it doesn't fall on the shoulders of specific individuals, et cetera. We are also at that period where we have chair and vice chair elections. So we will work through that. And I would also like to have a general discussion on outreach and engagement. It was a topic that was deferred from the last council call. And that's general outreach and engagement, separate and distinct from outreach and engagement related to the CWG and the CCWG, which I think is, that's its own conversation. So that's the agenda for the morning. Because of the format of this room, it's not exceptionally conducive to a small meeting of 8 or 9 people. And as a result, we've turned the tables around to give us the format that we have. Unfortunately, there aren't individual mics, so we will have to just simply pass the roving mics back and forth with each other. We have Celia on the phone, on the conference call, so if we don't use the mic, she won't be able to hear. So we do need to use the mic. And Celia, since we can't see you and I don't have Adobe Connect, if you want to join the conversation, please just jump in and let me know, and we'll get you into the conversation.
Great. I'll be rude, gladly.
Yes. when you speak, you're omnipresent in this room, so we can all hear you. You're the voice from above.
All right. From the West.
Yes. So with that, would anybody like to add anything to the proposed topics of conversation for this morning? They are regular, fairly standard for the council workshop, more administrative business for us, with the exception of word from the FOI. So with that...
Could I request that we just bash the agenda slightly and put the FOI working group to the to last thing on this agenda? And the reason for that is that the GAC have been discussing the framework over the last couple of days. We understand there's some problems within the GAC about that, but not at all sure what the problems are and so on. So if we can use a break today to catch up on that, then I'll feel that it'll be a more fulsome update later.
Okay, we can do that. And that probably raises the other issue. Rest assured, I will not make us all sit here for four straight hours. We will have regular breaks to do emails and have discussion and bio breaks. So don't worry, it won't be 4 hours straight. And with that, if we could have as much engagement as possible, that would be very helpful. So of the four key items, administrative items for the morning, we'll flip the FOI to the end of the morning session, and as such then roll into the roles and responsibilities of the CCNSO Council, in part just to restate the expectations of our of councillors, what does it mean to be a councillor, some of the issues that we've experienced in terms of quorum, et cetera, and wanted to have some conversation about that in terms of how do we continue to improve the performance and participation of the council itself. And there has been some discussion, as I mentioned, about should there be term limits anywhere within the group or within working groups, et cetera, not as councillors per se, but should any of the working groups on a more regularized basis see councillors flowing in and out of the working groups, especially for the standing ones, which is travel funding and triage. So that it's not just the same few people always doing the work on those working groups, that they can have some expectation that they are able to leave the working group at some point and that new blood will participate in the working group at some point. So those are some of the general conversations that I thought would be worth having, as well as revisiting the current roles and responsibilities, and taking into account hopefully some of the conversation we'll have around the points I've just raised. So maybe if I could just ask a question around the potential for term limits on standing committees. Is that something that makes sense? Is there any agreement or thoughts? Or is it a bad idea? Young, and then Nigel, and then Peter. There's one mic for each table. Young-um?
I just have a general procedural comment. Would it be possible to have the topics up on the screen? Because we usually do, and today we don't. Is there a way we could do that?
Can we do that? Then you have to turn your head.
I can do that.
Just to reiterate, we'll be talking about roles and responsibilities, chair and vice chair elections, engagement, and then we will conclude the morning with FOI. And in the meantime, Bart will put those items up on the screen. Nigel?
Thank you, Byron. I understood you to ask two questions just now. One was how could perhaps council work more efficiently, and the other one was whether term limits are appropriate or would be helpful. I'm going to answer the first one, the second one first, if that's all right. I don't see any strong views, people leaping up to shout out about term limits. I'm just going to express my opinion. I think they're not necessary or appropriate at this time. I think the problem is encouraging participation at all. If you have artificial term limits, you'll have people disqualified from committees and perhaps nobody to replace them. I'm always a great believer in the view that if you've got somebody who's prepared to do a job and they want to carry on doing it and being elected or however it is in any position and they're willing to carry on doing it, well, snatch the hand off. Obviously, you know, committees and things do sometimes get stale and term limits are there for a good reason, but I'm not sure at that stage. But I'm not very strong.
Thank you, Nigel. Peter?
Thank you, Ryan. Peter Larosa from Center. I agree with Nigel. I think it's important to realize what problem we are trying to solve. If the problem is that we think there should be new blood streaming into those working groups, people with new IDs, then there are probably other ways to tackle that than by imposing term limits. By coincidence, we're having the same discussion within Center. We are strengthening our working groups, and part of that strengthening exercises to look at the role of the chairs. At the moment, those chairs do not have a term limit. In that discussion, there were a couple of things that emerged. First of all, the sitting chairs, which would be the participants in the current working groups, they were somewhat offended that we brought up the topic. So it's definitely something to take into account. We made a mistake of only looking at it from a perspective that these people will be happy that somebody would be there to take over their role. They're not necessarily happy that somebody would be liking to do that. But like Nigel, I would just keep on focusing on encouraging new participants, and that will almost naturally allow people to step out if they are fed up, knowing that some capable minds and hands are there to take over their role if that would come up. But I would not push it as an effort to limit the terms of those currently on any of those working groups.
Thank you, Peter. Keith?
Thanks, Byron. We are struggling as a constituency and as a council to have a high level of enthusiasm from we're frequently not getting volunteers for working groups and so on and so on. So I think for that reason, term limits are probably a bad idea because you may be eliminating your only enthusiastic people on a topic purely because of time, and we would be better to continue with their enthusiasm where it's appropriate. So I think maybe in some ways the more important issue is how we can encourage enthusiastic people to be more participative and not stand in their way. But we don't have a long list of people, it appears to me, volunteering to come forward and do things. So I think we should be happy with anyone who's happy to serve. And it's quite difficult and challenging, I think, in today's world for people to find the time to voluntarily give up time and serve on council and so on.
And just to be clear, too, I did state it, but I just want to reiterate. I was talking specifically about the two standing committees, not the ad hoc committees. Even something like SOP, which has been ongoing, is not a standing committee. It may feel like it, but it's not a standing committee. We only have two, and those were the only ones that I was really talking about. Peter?
While realizing that, indeed, this is Peter Larosso from Center, while realizing, indeed, that there is that limitation that we're talking about those two groups, when Keith was speaking, I was just wondering if there's anything we could do to actually thank those that are doing the work in the working groups, which could also help as an encouragement to others to actually join. And it might be a wild idea, and maybe the secretariat would not be very enthusiastic about it, but would we consider, or should we consider, doing something special on an ICANN meeting for participants in working groups? And that could be as simple as inviting to a cocktail. Only those active participants could be joining there, or even a dinner if you're really wild. But that they have an incentive, that they get something in return. Most importantly, a thank you for the work that they're doing.
That's probably a very good idea. Keith?
Just thinking about the other side of the coin too, the idea that if people aren't participating, maybe we should have a rule to eliminate them from serving on a committee if they haven't attended three meetings in a row or something like that, so that we are not just keeping a seat open for people who don't want to participate. So maybe there's that negative connotation as well.
Thanks, Keith. And I just want to draw attention to Becky departing. Yes, there are some conflicting meetings for CCWG which have come up very late in the game. So Becky is going to be withdrawing from this, but coming back to join us later. Good luck. Right. Yeah. Did you want to say something? No. Okay. Okay, that's, I think, Peter, that's probably a very good idea and probably balanced with Keith's notion that after a certain amount of time, people be withdrawn, if they're not participating at all, that they're withdrawn from the working group. Do we have, Bart... Do we actually have any rules on that?
No, not really. There are in the council rules themselves, but not on working groups.
So they're not really rules in the charter, etc., themselves, especially for the council committees. On term limits or on participation rate, and that is what we see from the secretariat is one of the issues. Say with the two real standing committees, is fortunately there are always say three person committees, so you at least need two persons. But the structurally, some people are not showing up, or they show up after months, and that makes it very easy and you become very dependent on the two who show up. So that's a bit of an issue is there as well.
Thanks, Bart. So perhaps the challenge there, first off, I don't hear any support for term limits, even in just the very narrowly defined spectrum that I was raising the issue on. But what I am hearing is if we are going to do anything in terms of participation on the working groups, it should probably just be articulated within the charters themselves, that after three meeting no-shows or some number, that one would cease to be a member of a given working group. And that gives the opportunity to put out the call again to then get new blood into the working group. Is that something that would make sense? Because we have, the practical fact of the matter is that a number of the working groups are being sustained by ever smaller numbers of people who do all the heavy lifting, even though there may be a large number of names on the list. And I think that it does two things. One, it will serve to reinforce the notion that if you're going to be on the working group, you actually have to participate. You can't be there in name alone. And that two, if people are exiting the working group, it much more crisply allows us to make a fresh call for participation. Young-un?
I think that could be one very good way of actually a roundabout way of encouraging participation. And also, it would also enable people who had good intentions at first but were not able to do what they thought they could to actually opt out. Because currently we don't have a formal mechanism for opting out. Besides the people actively stating that they were not, they're not going to be a part of the group. So I think after a while things can kind of seem less important than they were at first. And so I think this would be a very good. It would be a very good way. And also I support the idea that we should not have a term limit. Just as Keith has said, if anyone's willing to put their effort in, they're most very welcome to.
Thank you. Hey, yeah, this is Jordi. I concur with which has been said in the group here, which I would like just to point out that maybe something that may help to encourage people to participate could be to know exactly what expected to do in a working group. You may join because it might be interesting for you or whatever. There is other people there, but sometimes it's about the scope. Okay, what am I exactly supposed to do? How can we coordinate among ourselves? And somehow, I would say that, is have an anticipation of the workload you're going to have. Say, okay, the issue is such big, but we're going to split the job in such a way that I'm just going to focus on that because, well, beside that, we have other lives, and maybe that lack of vision of what's expecting you behind the curtain is a little bit scary and maybe frustrating the willingness of people to really join.
So this is Byron. So what you're suggesting is that before the working group gets started or really up and running, that there is a clear expectation set of the level of effort and work and subject matter.
If not clear, because maybe very, very difficult, at least a vision of that. We're going to decide or we're going to discuss about whatever issue. So is that just a CCNSO issue or are we going to participate with other ACs, SOs, whatever? Where are the areas in which we're going to focus? These, on that. Are we all going to deal with the three areas or maybe we're each one is going to focus on another, on a specific one, and then we share and we review. So it's not just, okay, let's participate, and then you face that, okay, you have to send the meetings, there are zillions of documents to read, et cetera, et cetera. But, okay, as I cannot take all, let me just focus on one thing. Let me do just one specific thing, and I will help with that. And then another one. So let's eat the elephant piece by piece.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. And not exactly the way you've articulated it, but recently for the working groups, the CWG and the CCWG, we actually asked the applying members to write a response to us that showed that they were interested, that they had the time, and for those ones, they also had to include support from their institutions or organizations of their day job. So wherever they work had to also put in writing that they were willing to support the time required by that individual. So we are trying to do a little bit of that, but I think you make a good point that even if it's not crystal clear what the level of effort will be before the work group gets started, that as much as possible there is some indication of the level of effort expected. Abibu?
Abibu from .tz. I support the idea, but since you have said there are no specific rules, and these conditions have to be included in the charter, now I would like some clarification on the issue of three consecutive meetings, because it might happen that I'm not available for three consecutive meetings, but for maybe one or two, there was a very valid reason for why I did not participate. So it should be clear. Yeah.
Agreed. And that, I think, if we can start incorporating that into charters, that, again, that just there's clarity of expectation that if you're missing more than three meetings, four or more, that at that point one would withdraw from the working group. So, or at least, maybe it's not automatic, but at least there has to be a formal conversation about why. I mean, we all have day jobs, and often they can prevent us from participating, but there should be the expectation that you will be available at least every third meeting for a working group, but there may be exceptions. But, you know, something in the charter that at least formalizes that idea while providing some flexibility that our day jobs do get in the way for our volunteer jobs here from time to time. Yang'am?
I think if we qualify the if you miss more than three meetings without a valid reason, that would take care of things.
Hero?
Maybe I missed. I'm sorry, Hero from the JP. Maybe I missed what all others said. But the before soliciting members for the working group, it's better for us to have a list of expertise that the working group will need, and so that candidates or volunteers can raise their hand for what purpose or something. And if we cannot, collect all the expertise needed, we have to solicit the second round to get more members for that.
So that's a good point. Not just the number of members, but the required expertise for a given subject, whatever it is. And that perhaps if we don't get it in the first call, we should have a second call. And I'm not, you know, there is always the possibility to reach outside the community for specific expertise if that's required. Okay, so I generally hear a willingness that should be incorporated into future charters, that it should be explicit while acknowledging some flexibility. The expectation of participation should be explicit. However, there should be some flexibility for extenuating circumstances. Bart, I trust you've taken note of that. Thank you. Thank you.
Byron, can I say something?
Please, go ahead.
Sometimes people will not be to participate in meetings, but we can still participate in the discussions. So I think maybe we contemplate a way to recognize that still participate asynchronously, still be part of where we being part of the meeting.
Celia, it's very difficult to hear you, and I think you cut out a couple times on that, on us. Could you restate what you just said?
Yeah, I'm having a return on my voice. Oh, all right. I will try to fix it now.
Okay, Youngum is going to try to restate what you just said for us. Because I have to admit, I was having trouble.
I think what Celia was trying to say is what Abiba just whispered to me a while ago, saying that even though you cannot participate in the formal meetings, you may be participating in the discussions in between. And I think that's what Celia was trying to say, that we should also take that into consideration. Is that right, Celia?
Yeah, that is correct. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. And that's a fair point.
I just sent you an email with the URL for Adobe Room. So, Celia, if you can hear us, so you can use the chat as well in case you want to interfere, etc. So it makes it easier for this conversation with two microphones.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think unless there's any further comment, that probably concludes the discussion around term limits, which there will be none, and participation in working groups, which we will start to introduce the concept of minimum participation in the charter. But with a final comment on that, Keith?
Just another thing before we leave this behind, I think. I'm wondering whether there might be a need to, at council level too, to have some sort of executive empowerment process, so that if there isn't a quorum on calls, for council or for working groups, that there somehow is a methodology by which we can get decisions made and commitments made, because it's quite frustrating at times to not have that. So whether that shouldn't be something that, if we're going to start to dig into the bylaws, we might want to put some review over.
Thanks, Keith. And certainly the point is well made, in that it can be very frustrating, particularly for those who are actually on the call or in the meeting, et cetera. If there isn't quorum, then you can't actually go forward with any decisions. And I know that's been the case on a couple of council, monthly council calls, and it's certainly very frustrating for the folks who are on the call to not be able to go forward with their actions. I think we should probably take that as a to-do for further review in terms of is there a way to deal with that? So I will ask that Bart take note of that. Or Bart, you have a comment too?
Yeah, I've taken note of this, and as you may recall, we have this group that will review some of the guidelines. And one of the guidelines is on council meetings, another one is on CC&O meetings, and another one is setting up working groups. So all these suggestions will be taken into account for that working group, which will be led by Katrina, who is unfortunately not here. But.
Right. Katrina will be here shortly, though. Okay, well, with that, we'll move on address the next subject, which is really around some of the expectations that we have as councillors, and then into the roles and responsibilities, where Bart is going to put up the traditional review of what we have had and where we're going in the coming year to start to think about and assign some of those roles and responsibilities. But certainly in terms of the expectations of us, those to a great degree remain unchanged, but there's always, I think, good reason to reiterate. And that, and we've already touched on it, is the expectation of attendance, at least in our monthly council meetings. We know many months, if not with a year in advance of when those meetings are. In order to make any decisions as required, we have to have quorum, which means both numbers and regional diversity.
And we have had some challenges with that, so I would strongly encourage and ask everybody, you know, please participate in the meetings. It's critical, especially from a geography point of view, that we have somebody from each region participate. Some of us have to get up very early or stay up very late to participate in these meetings, and like I say, it can be extremely frustrating when you make that commitment and yet we can't take any decisions. Nigel.
This is only partly tongue-in-cheek. Can we perhaps make funding dependent on attendance?
Travel funding? Interesting thought. Peter?
Thank you. Peter, also from Centre. Yes, but maybe have a stick and a carrot. And that can work nicely together with dinner or drinks for those active in the working groups. It would be nice. But that wasn't the point. I'm sorry.
Participation
oh,
in
yes,
the calls.
Sorry. Regional organizations might be able to help out a bit in thinking our regional councillors and making sure that at least sufficient number of them are on the call. Unless the CCNSO secretariat is already doing that.
I would say anywhere that we can prod our members to participate, I would encourage. And I think the ROs certainly could have a role in that. I mean, these are your region's councillors who are, or in some cases, are not showing up. And it would strike me, of course, that your regions have good reason to try to remind them to participate in the CCNSO council meetings. Bart, did you have your hand up?
No, I'm thinking about, say, what to do.
Say what could be helpful. It's say from a secretariat perspective, I don't know if it's helpful for councillors. Say we can send out say calendar invites to ensure that it's in your calendar. That's one way of dealing with it. Say what we already do is at every meeting there is this. It's part of the agenda. When is the next meeting, etc. So people know. But still, people don't show up. And unfortunately, if you really would look at it, they're always the same people. So you have a bit of a question, and that's what I see is, and that's why I suggested it to Byron, say, what is the commitment of a councillor? What are you willing to commit? Is it because it's nice on your, I'll be very blunt now, is it nice on your CV? Or are you willing, have you been asked and say, oh, I will do it? Or, yeah, why are you councillor? And what do you expect to do? So that's a bit of the frustration we have in even having these council committees up and running. Say people commit to it, and it's also part of the broader outreach and engagement. Say if the quorum or if the council is not quorate, it is not a very good example. And especially for people all around the world, and that's why it's a bit of frustration, and we're frustrated about it, and not just me.
Tell us how you really feel, Bart. That was some of that Dutch frankness, right? But it's absolutely true. Very frustrating for those of us who are on the call and can't make decisions because we don't have quorum. So I think there's actually a couple of good ideas, right, that we've just heard. One is, we send emails out to everybody and reminders, but let's actually put in their diaries or their calendars an invite so they see it there. In spite of some of the challenges with time zones, at least it's there. And then perhaps we could actually ask the ROs, and we could remind the ROs to remind your respective counselors so that then those counselors are getting... They see it long in advance on our agendas. They see it in their calendar. They're getting an email from Secretariat, and they're being reminded by their own regional organizations. At that point, nobody can say they were unaware. Keith?
And to add to that, could we have a name and shame in terms of at the end of each series of minutes that are produced from the calls, have a list of all councillors' names and who was on the call, you know, at, or how many meetings so far this year they've attended, so that there would be some pressure going on those who haven't attended it's a fact, so why not state the facts?
I'll go with Nigel and then Bart.
Just to follow on briefly from what Keith just said, in the elections for our territorial government, just before election time, they publish an annual summary of how many meetings that the various representatives have attended of which committees. So you can actually see which of your elected representatives has actually been working during their term, just before you get to choose them for another term or not.
Let me put it this way. I hate to compare with the GNSO, but that standing practice in the GNSO for every working group, etc., they do a recording of presence. Those who apologize, those who attended, and those who lack of attendance.
Yeah.
It's part of that. Though we do apologies. That's the difference. Apologies say that's a good... I think that's a very good method. If people cannot make it for whatever reasons, they send us an email and then it's fine. But not showing up and not informing either the chair or the secretariat or somebody else, I think, yeah, it's think what you think about it.
Oh, back down the line. Very
quickly. Yeah, this is Xing Qiao. Following on what Bart just said, that I think recently, I still recalled my GNO's days past few years, but the last year they have the practice of letting the members of the working group know that whether you like to actively participate or you just simply like to observe. So that actually there's the two categories that you can choose to be in. If you like to be actively participate, meaning that every meeting you have to to attend. If not, you have to send an apology. Or you can actually become a mailing list, the observer, and that it's easier for the chair to manage the group as well.
May I ask a question for clarification? Is there a difference in status? I've attended some of these cross-community working groups, and some of the GNSO working groups, and what you see sometimes is, as an observer, you're not allowed to speak up. So it's just, you're just a silent listener. Question whether you want this or, yeah.
And that is not dissimilar to what we've done with the CWG and CCWG, where we've delineated members and participants. I think participants still get allowed to speak in those environments, but only members get to vote, which is an important distinction. And to me, it probably at least merits trying that people can sign up to be a member where you get to vote and the expectation is higher versus a participant or an observer where you're allowed in the room, you're enabled in the room to keep informed, but you're not a voting member. Actually, that's probably a good suggestion. And maybe I could pick on the notion of attendance again. All our minutes do show who was present and who sent apologies in advance. But they're just in the minutes, essentially in a narrative form, like every other agenda item, that you see them once and they're only there for the previous meeting or the specific meeting in question. Perhaps at the end of all minutes, to start with, we could put in a matrix that shows the running total for the year. Pardon me, building on Keith's idea, and that in every set of minutes, would be that running total of members' attendance. I'll go Keith and then Peter.
Just a further suggestion. If you had, say it's for council meetings, at the end of it's just a summary of meetings attended, councillors' names on the left, number of meetings attended so far is X, and then the ones they've apologised for missing, and then the ones they were just absent and didn't even apologise. And I think that becomes quite telling as a process. I mean, it's a record, it's a matter-of-fact record, but it helps to encourage people to participate, if they're unable to participate, to apologise and give it proper consideration, so that when I get up at 2 a.m., I'm not disappointed that we can't make the decisions we said we would make. Because we don't have a quorum. And I think for us it's really the only way forward that we can start to help to encourage people who merely want the concept of being a councillor on their CV, as Bart puts it, to separate them from people who want the CCNSO to progress and do things and go forwards. So very important to me.
Thanks, Keith. Peter?
Thank you. Peter Haroste from Centre. I agree with the proposal. I think the running record is a good one, and it's a positive one as well. Something that is not necessarily helping with attendance, on the contrary, could actually have a negative effect, but it would help with the quorum, is would it make sense if the secretariat asks those that send an apology if they can give a proxy vote? I don't know what the statutes say about it.
I'm not sure. I think we'd have to investigate that, and just my initial gut reaction, I would be somewhat apprehensive about that. Nigel?
Well, I'm going to disagree with Peter and agree with Byron on that, but for a slightly different reason. I don't think we care about whether who votes on thing. What we're looking for is active participation and the use of the person's brain on the call.
Is this a follow-up to the... Okay.
Say, from a practical point of view, a non-quorum is not really relevant. There is, say, if you look at the necessity of making quick decisions, we can do it by email as well, which we do a lot, which you do a lot as councillors. There are a lot of emails going out which effectively are votings by saying, if you have any objections, please state so. Then we put it on the agenda. If there are no objections, effectively it's a decision. And we can do that, say, in 2 or 3 days. A lot of these decisions are taken in between sessions. So the voting itself or making the decision is not really the issue. It's having a fulsome call and having a fulsome discussion. That's the real issue, and we run everything in preparation of these meetings.
Carolina, then Keith.
Yes, Carolina Guerre for the records. I strongly support the idea of showing, I mean, the list of attendance, it's a bit of like shaming, naming situation. It might be a little bit like that for some, but I think at the end of the day, one can read it as the accountability and the responsibility a councillor assumes. And I mean, it's not just getting, and I'm going to be very blunt about this, funding to attend ICON meetings and the proper status on the CV by joining the council. I mean, it needs a commitment, it needs to show, and it needs to, I mean, we just don't want surprises in future times when maybe there are some councillor candidates who are not sure about what this commitment means and how accountable they should be to their respective constituencies. So I'm very much for this motion of transparency in the list, in the attendance of annual meetings. I mean, maybe January or late December would be a good time to publish that and make it.
And I think Caroline actually makes a really good point there. This isn't, what we're talking about is entirely consistent and actually living up to the ideals of accountability, responsibility, and very importantly, transparency, which in theory is what this model is all about. And I think that's a really good point. Keith?
It
raises in my mind the idea of an executive power as well, that perhaps the chair and vice chairs, and maybe we expand the number of vice chairs or something, but something along those lines, be empowered to make decisions where there hasn't been a quorum, but there is a need by a certain date to have a decision. And maybe that is an issue of the chair and vice chairs getting on the phone and ringing people who weren't on the call and saying, you know, what's your decision, and then recording that and having the authority to then act. So whether we can examine whether that's permissible under our bylaws or something, I don't know. But there seems to me to be an absolute need for us to be able to progress on those occasions where we're not fully quorate.
Thanks, Keith. So we are going to take that as an action item, right? Okay. Thank you. Unless there are any final comments, we'll move on. Okay, so Young M will give you the final comment, and then we're going to move on to the actual roles, which Bart is going to walk us through. But just before we do that, so after Young M's comment, but before we transition into that, we'll take a five-minute break so people can do emails or whatever, stand up, walk around, and get reinvigorated for the roles and responsibilities. Young M.
Thanks, Baron Naomi. I strongly support the idea of the matrix thing. I admit I'm also a bit guilty of a couple of times not. The times are changing, and sometimes I think it's the next day or the day before, and so I sometimes I miss it. But that would that's something that should be the responsibility of the counselor. As for the issue of proxy vote and the empowerment of the chair and the vice chairs, I think those are very valid ideas that should be explored maybe more in detail, but not in this format. But we should make clear the circumstances under which the chairs and the vice chairs may make certain decisions, give the proxy vote to council members of the same region, maybe. So there can be some instances where it would make sense if a person cannot really, if there is a valid reason for a person not being able to participate, we should certainly discuss the idea of the proxy vote, but in a more in-depth, in a more elaborative manner. Thanks,
Young Am. So with that, we'll take a five-minute break and then come back, let Bart set up, and come back for roles and responsibilities. All right, so when we return, get on the Adobe Room. So, yeah, and you'll have 5 minutes to get organized. Is very well represented, yes, fully represented. Okay, let's regroup and come back to the workshop. Well, we've gone more than 5 minutes. Bart, let's get going, please.
So, in the Adobe room, what you see right now is effectively the basis for the whole roles and responsibilities division. Say, some time ago when Chris stepped down, we started to look as a council into what he was doing, because until that point, it was very clear Chris was doing a lot of things without any clear understanding of what it all entailed of being a chair, etc. As a result, we started, after listing these, we started to cluster them, and effectively what it meant is you got, say, relational aspects to being a, or council work, and the administration of the CCNSO itself. And the administration of the CCNSO itself is probably the core of the council calls themselves, so that's around management and oversight of the activities of the CCNSO, and more or less coordination of activities with other SOs and ACs. And the relational aspects are representation and engagement, and represent the CCNSO in institutional, in a more institutional role, and engage on behalf of the CCNSO in other activities around the CCNSO. So that's the background, more or less, of the matrix we've been using over time. So I'll now go to another one, which we'll show you in just a minute. Browse my computer. Here it comes. This is where we started out, say, what I just said, the clusters in the background. This is the list of tasks identified at the time. Now, we don't need to go probably over all these tasks because some have become obsolete, but it gives you a basic idea, and after the call I will resend this document again so you have a bit of understanding of the history of the roles and responsibilities. And what you will see is a number in front of all these tasks, and what it really meant is going back to the agenda of what is relational or administrative. So you see there, again, manage the, so some have tasks have been added over time, like manage the work plan, manage the framework for roles and responsibilities. Some have become obsolete, like the board breakfasts, and some are still there, like coordination between chair and vice chairs. So that is more or less the background where we are. Now, I'll turn into last year's roles and responsibilities, and I think the goal of this year is, first of all, check whether all these roles are still relevant, and then secondly, I need to scroll down, I believe, yep, just a minute. when I was there. And secondly, who and which groups are going to perform which roles? So that's that one. Just a minute. That's the good thing of having Adobe on. I'm almost there. And I will start with... Here we are. The administrative roles of the CCNSO as identified at the time. So the only thing we need to do, file exceeds 50 characters. Ugh. What is this? I'm sorry, I can't open this one. I have to rename it. There you are. I will increase the size a little bit. Can you see it? Yeah. So what you see effectively is this is the way that was divided at the time. These are the relational roles that were identified last year. Say the first one was the formal liaison with the board, and it was the chair's prerogative. The question is, should that change or not? So that's probably the easiest way of to run through it. The second one is the formal liaison with the other AC and SO chairs. Again, that was a chair's prerogative. You could imagine, say, especially with that one, that vice chairs would be involved as well because there is a lot of burden, so it's easier also to invite vice chairs on some of these calls, but that's more, Byron, that's your call, whether that's worthwhile. And then the formal liaison with the GAC chair, that was more or less that replaced the working of the CCNSO GAC working group, and maybe it's time, say, with the new GAC chair to have a discussion whether that one should be reconstituted, because we still have it pending, and Keith was chair of that one. Now it's more between you and Thomas Schneider, but we could reconstitute that one, that prepare the one of its jobs was to prepare the meetings with the GAC to make them more lively. So that's maybe a conversation to be had. And then CCNSO, preparation of CCNSO report, and then CCNSO report itself, that became, we could do it, say, with last year we did it this way, speaking engagements was for all, board meetings, etc. That's also all there is. Informal liaison with board and board members, probably that's something that needs to be done with for all in future, and informal liaison with the GAC members as well. And these are, I think it's making it clearer that it's not just the prerogative of the chair to limit the workload on the chair, because there is a lot of this. Any questions or suggestions? So this was as what was agreed upon last year.
Thanks, Bart. I know I'm going to be highly conflicted in what I say here looking at this list, but noting that, I'm going to suggest that perhaps with the exception of the top three items, the formal liaison roles, that most of the rest of them should be an all-member activity. I mean, informal liaison with board and GAC members, wherever we can reach out and touch board and GAC members, we should be when we have the opportunity. And, of course, underlying that is an assumption that when we're doing that in our role as counselor, that we're doing it to the best of our ability on behalf of the council and the CCNSO. And I say that because if there are specific issues that relate to your organization, then you can wear that hat, but you should be identifying that with GAC or board members. But when you're speaking as part of the CCNSO Council, I think it behooves us all to take up that role when we have the opportunity with board and GAC members. So that would be my suggestion, that the bottom four X's that show under the chair's role should actually be better defined as an all-person role, set of roles.
If people do this and start doing this actively, that they report back. So I'll include that a bit in the description of the roles and responsibilities. Say, if it's all, then there is a clear reporting back mechanism so everybody's aware of what's going on.
That's probably a good idea, and that when we at the council meetings have a report from members, vice chairs, chair, et cetera, that's the kind of thing that a councillor could report on, interaction with a GAC member on subject X. It doesn't have to be deep, but just let us know when you've had the opportunity in your role as a councillor to specifically interact with GAC or board members. Any other comments or thoughts on that matrix? Peter?
Peter from Center. I think there's a very thin line there in reporting on interaction you had in your role as a counselor and reporting in more in general. For instance, I would be talking quite often to GAC, in particular a subgroup of the European GAC members and those representing the high-level internet group that is formed by the European Commission, but I would not be doing so because I'm a CCNSO Council member. I would be happy to inform, but then you might get an information overload if everybody just starts sharing random exchanges that they had with GAC members. So I'm not clear on what you're asking from us. If you're asking us to report on exchanges we had because we are a member of the CCNSO Council, I think you would get very few bits of information from that.
So I guess if I tried to create an example, so it's a fair question, and my underlying assumption is that we're reasonable folks with filters that we can apply here, so we're not going to overload a council meeting with updates that are not helpful. But, you know, for example, if Keith is talking to GAC members on behalf of the on subjects related to the FOI, that would be a relevant update. Keith could say, I spoke to X, Y, and Z parties about issues related to the FOI. And it's more just to keep us informed about who's talking about what to who. As it pertains to CCNSO matters. So in your example, if you're talking to a subset of the GAC on European-specific issues for really issues more directly related to your RO, then no, that probably wouldn't be something you could surface or would need to surface unless something relevant came out of it. Does that help parse what I'm looking for?
Yes, it does indeed. And I think your example is an excellent illustration, because you suggest that Keith, in his role as chair of the FOI, would talk to somebody. I would find it hard to come up with a reason why I, as a council member, would talk to somebody.
Well, perhaps Nigel, who's a council member, not the chair of the FOI, but a member of the FOI, in his capacity there, same thing, but he's doing it as a councillor. And, you know, there's just a reasonableness here. If you think it is of the weight and gravitas that it merits surfacing it here to the council, then we should do it. If it's a hallway conversation for 2 minutes, probably not. Carolina? And then Nigel?
Thank you. Sometimes I have exchanges with the CCNSO council members from LAC, and I ask them, I know that they are having this interesting conversation. Let's put it this way now. Olga Cavalli is vice chair at CAC. So it's very, and she's a very accessible person. I mean, she is there and talking to regional CCTLDs. So let's say Victor or Margarita, they have this conversation. Maybe they would be interested to know, okay, so what is the .cl, the Chilean GAC representative doing or thinking of that. And there might be something interesting coming out of that conversation, but I think it would be great if councillors would then be aware, Margarita in this case, in this hypothetical example, that she would be able to sort of distribute this information if it's a relevant or general information pertaining the whole council or the CCTLD world in general. Sometimes there are these conversations that you need to make aware to the councillor that they might be talking about their specific example, and they might get some general lessons to share with their colleagues at the council level. I'm sorry. So.
Yeah, and I think that's the point, that all of us have to use a set of filters saying, I think this would be relevant to my colleagues. And I guess that's the fundamental test. Is this relevant to my colleagues in my capacity as a CCNSO council member? And if the answer is yes, then surface it. And if we get a flood and it's too much, then maybe we'll apply a higher filter. But for now, the point is just, as councillors, we all have a certain, I would say, responsibility in our role as councillor to be advocates and ambassadors for the CCNSO in general. And in that context, if we're talking to GAC members or board members and something of interest comes up, feel free to report back. And if we get too many of them, then maybe we can apply another filter, but we probably won't. Bart, carry on.
I'll include that one, say the bit about reporting in updating the roles and responsibilities. So that was that one. The good thing is I had time to adjust the title of the other one. So, and this is more the, what you will see right now are more the oversight management coordination roles of the council, and this is where you see the committees as well. Again, chair meetings, etc., most of them are probably very clear. The ones I think which are, maybe just run through the ones I think are relevant. You can have a look yourself. As well, if we can enlarge it. This is too large. Most are self-explanatory, like chairing council meetings, chairing CCNSO meetings. So as a formal chair, not as a sessions chair, because we do have session chairs, which I think is a good one. Staff members meeting an agenda, etc. And that's chair, vice chair. Liaison with staff for meeting minutes, etc. Nigel Roberts was there. What was that? Was the application of new membership? So I don't know whether you want to continue in that role, but that may be something else that's not there anymore, but that's the one. Liaison with staff with general management issues, that's, again, the chair, management CC&O framework. This framework, it's probably either a chair or a vice chair role. It's nothing but, it's at least we have somebody to start talking about. That's what it means. The day-to-day management is more something that we do. Then you manage oversight work plan. Again, that's a chair thing that was in particular introduced by Leslie. Oversight PBDPs, that's all again oversight management working groups or oversight board selection and council elections. That these are the regular elections we have ongoing within the CC&SO. Liaisons, appointments, and NOMCOM rep appointments is ongoing. And there will be a new one. Byron, do you want to introduce it here or at the end, the one around ethos? Because, yeah.
ICANN has asked us to provide a couple of council members as participants in the ethos award selection committee. I think you'll probably remember, actually, it was Leslie who won it last year. And there's a committee put together by ICANN, which has representatives from the various communities, and they work to surface award winners for contribution to ICANN in general. And Leslie was one of the winners last year. But it looks like it's going to become a more regularized committee. Last year was sort of the first one and a bit more ad hoc, and they have asked that we put forward two councillors to participate in that committee for choosing the ethos award winners on an annual basis. So that's something that's not here right now but is going to be regularized, which needs to be included here, and it's two councillors for that. I don't know what the workload is at this point, but I suggest that it's not unreasonable, but would you like to speak to that?
It is not an unreasonable amount of work, but let's say that in the month prior to the election, you will have at least a weekly meeting. I mean, you will need to devote at least in the previous month 8 hours of your time, I mean, just to go through all the letters and CVs again, and I mean, the last month it can get a bit overloaded.
And just to be clear, Carolina can say that because she was one of our two members from last year. So we should include that as a line item here, and it's identifying specifically two council members. Yeah, the council meeting, that we should put that on the agenda for the council meeting. Yes, and I think separately we should send out an email to the council asking for volunteers for that one. Carry on.
So I think this was all self-explanatory. The only thing is maybe just going back, Nigel, are you still willing to do that? Managing the formal approval process as you did?
I'd be happy to pass it on, but I'd be happy to keep it if there's nobody stepping forward.
Nobody will step
forward.
Carry on.
And Hong.
Yeah, Hong is out, I know, and that's the triage committee. She's been replaced by Celia already. So we have Celia, Katrina, and Margarita. All three are not here present yet. Wednesday, maybe I will ask. You know, I know Margarita, it will be difficult to touch base. I don't know. Do you know whether she wants to stay on? Or?
No, I'm not sure what her plans are, but I will not expect Margarita to join the call on Wednesday. No, not at all. No.
Does she reply to email?
It's really her summer time
off,
but I think she's at
why.
The beach, and with the time difference, it'll be very, very difficult for her.
I'm just noting that we have two members from the same region in this committee, and wondering if that's something that we should be concerned about, or is that okay with us? I would just like to point that out. Okay.
Just for the record, so everybody understands, Hong has been replaced by Celia, so Celia is part of the triage committee. And then the final one, and this is workload prioritization. Again, it's part of the work plan, etc. The travel funding committee, and that's Katrina, Dotty, and Victor. Again, probably, say Dotty and Victor will not be around, maybe joining on the call on Wednesday, maybe. The idea is ask them by, say, email confirmation whether they want to continue their role or step down. And let's go further down. Informal coordination, assigned activities. It doesn't mean anything. Maybe I will suggest to clean up some of these line items as well. Some of them are very, they lost any meaning because they were used in the past. And if we can limit this as much as possible, it increases its clarity as well. And then the new one from last year was coordination ALAC CCNSO meetings. That's Margarita, Katrina, and the CCNSO appointed liaison to ALAC. That's Ron Sherwood, together with Maureen and others. And then coordination CCNSO GNSO council meetings. That's an important one, but that's still with the chair. Question is, do you want to maintain it that way, or should we strive to get something like the ALEC CCNSO council meetings? It doesn't entail very much. Say, most of the times it's an exchange of emails, and by now we've found a format that really works. It is management of the cross-community working groups in which we participate in hot topics. So that's all there is to it. Yeah. So let me scroll down if there is more to it. Nope, that was it. So, back to you. I think we've covered all, and the only important one is seek confirmation and try to limit this as much as possible and then put it on the agenda for Wednesday for final confirmation.
Thank you, Bart. Thank you. This is Ching. Just to, Brian, if you need any alternate or brand that I can offer to you to use on the CCNSO, GNSO coordination, I'll be happy to offer that if I can be of use.
That would be very helpful, actually. Yes, we will take you up on that. Be careful when you put your hand up. Right. Good, thank you. So I think that gives us a better sense, just a refining of what we've got in place right now for the year coming and a little bit of work to do in the council meeting around this. Yeah, so I think that, unless there are any final questions or comments, wraps up the roles and responsibilities section of the agenda, and we will now, seeing none, we will now roll over to Keith and an update on the FOI.
Okay, I'd hoped we'd see Becky back by now. All I can say is since the last ICANN meeting, we offered a meeting with the GAC, or GAC representatives who were interested, and we had that meeting by teleconference on the 22nd of January. There were a number of GAC members quite animated on the call, and we covered a lot of ground and seemed to have a great deal of harmony and far more harmony than we've had from the GAC in recent times on that call. However, subsequent to that, I can report that things have gone into a slight state of disarray, and the GAC seem to be clutching at straws in terms of not wanting to make a decision at all, and pinning that to suggesting that the FOI doesn't properly recognise the place of governments and such things. So it's gone from what I thought reasonably close to being resolvable and approvable by them at this meeting to perhaps a state of total chaos. But I'm not absolutely sure on that, because this is only second-hand feedback that I'm getting and Twitter feed and so on. So I think I'll update more accurately along the way, and we'll certainly get the feeling for what the GAC actually are saying and doing in the joint meeting. But hopefully, if there are issues, we can try and resolve them, and hopefully that's why Becky hasn't come back, that she's trying to resolve them now.
Nigel?
I don't want to steal the platform if anybody else wants to speak, because I was heavily involved in with Keith and others in formulating the framework, but it's very clear that to me that whoever is raising these sorts of issues at this time haven't a clue what we've been doing for 5 years in a joint working group with the GAC, and that makes me rather upset and angry that we've wasted 5 years of our very heavy work.
We have not wasted 5 years of intensive work. The CCNSO has placed an interim approval on the framework at its last meeting, and we took that to the GAC, saying we would like you to give your approval as well so that we can finalise this approval. Nothing changes the fact that the CCNSO can give its final approval, and that gives the framework status within the CCNSO. From that, the framework can be fed into the cross-community working group on IANA for them to paraphrase, extract recommendations or whatever they feel is appropriate to be part of the IANA transition as well. So the GAC's position on it is actually not that relevant. It's just that it was an initial hope that we would take the framework together with the CCNSO and the GAC, taking it to the ICANN board, so the ICANN board, because it would be coming from the GAC as advice from the GAC, would have to adopt it as well. However, the tenets of what's included in the framework can be set as part of the accountability mechanisms and part of the transition without the GAC's approval if necessary. Now, on the point of the GAC's apparent dismay at the framework, they say we don't fully acknowledge government and government's role. And in the introduction, we absolutely and utterly say the first principle is that local law will apply. I don't think we can make that any more clear. Whatever the local law is for the country, it applies to the CCTLD and the management of that CCTLD. We can't second guess how a country might interpret that or what they might do with that. That's their rule, their principles, and theirs, and so on. So I don't know if we have to repeat that as a precursor clause to everything else we say in the document every step of the way, but certainly we acknowledge the sovereignty right up front. So I don't understand what the problem is, and certainly we thrashed that out during the 5 years of negotiation. So I'm not... Yeah, I think probably what the actual issue is, even though we're on the record, I think the GAC have come to a point where they've got to make a decision, and they don't want to make a decision, and that's typical of the GAC and everything that they've done in all of history.
Any questions for Keith? Peter?
Thank you. Peter Van Rossen from Centre. Keith, just to refresh my memory, you did refer in the FOI work to the GAC principles, right?
Yes.
Thanks. So, and on a practical note, is there anything you could share with us in terms of which GAC members seem to have a knowledge gap so that they fail to understand what the FOI work has been about for the last 5 years. Can we talk to anybody in specific?
No, not at this stage. That's what I'm not sure of. The GAC have only started discussing this partly during their plenary yesterday and again this morning. So until I can know who it is and what the problems are. They've appointed Ornof Storm from .no, or from Norway, as the lead on the debate. And he's been involved in the discussions in recent times, and it seems to be quite moderate, so maybe he has been able to, you know, soothe the issues down or whatever, but with no discussion from me or between me in any formal sense, I really can't comment on who the protagonists are or what their actual and real issues are.
That's a perfect example and follow-up to the points we discussed earlier. Tomorrow we have with Centre coordination meeting with the European GAC members, and so we'd be very happy to bring that point to the table.
I hope when Becky returns from the GAC, and perhaps by the time we have our preparatory meeting later this afternoon, we'll have a bit more knowledge and understanding about what's happening. So perhaps let's not do anything now, and I'm sure we'll have time to put it on the agenda for a 5-minute update this afternoon, and let's see what we've gained by then. Yes, please. Sure.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions for FOI members or Keith? No? Okay. Yeah, that is that effectively wraps up the general discussion. We should have the chairs of the CWG and the CCWG coming shortly after noon. So why don't we take a no more than 10-minute break till 12:05, and we'll assume that they will be here in a timely fashion, or at least we can hope. So 12:05, let's regroup, and then we'll start the discussion about CWG and CCWG. Okay, it's 12:05. Let's reconvene, please. Celia, we are starting again. So, and Lisa will do an introduction, and the PowerPoint will be in the Adobe room.
Hello? Okay, I'll give you a short update on the CWG. And as you might know, we have made a discussion document regarding the models that are being discussed. And the discussion document, if you show the next slide, is actually, the purpose of this is to, of course, inform you all of the work we're doing. Furthermore, it's also to get input from the community on the different, well, on key issues and also on where do we see convergence, where is the divergence, and how do we find a new direction for this. So this is a document that we hope that all communities will discuss, and in the end there are some questions regarding the models and also regarding the IANA transition as a whole. I don't know if you know we have a revised timeline. That's also on this slide deck, and I'll show you in the end. But there is quite an extension of when we hope to submit a proposal for the ICG. But this is due to the complexity of this issue. So if you have any questions, just feel free to ask. Next slide. Oh, you want to... Yeah.
Are you happy to discuss the timeline now, Lisa, or would you like questions at the end?
I'm happy to discuss it now. Then I just think we should pull it up on Adobe. It's in the last part of the slide deck. So just if you find that part. Yeah. Yes. But this, the next slide is the actual timeline. These are why we're a little late.
Well, that renders beautifully, doesn't it?
I know, it's small. I don't know if you can try and make it a little bigger, but
yeah.
Okay.
Okay, look, the question is that the IANA transition group meeting yesterday and the day before, we did re-look at and rejig this timeline substantially on the basis of the new commitment you'd made. But I noticed there were a couple of things, like there was a second round of consultation that you'd originally had that you've now dropped. It doesn't appear to be as noticeable there. So the real question is, has the working group provided this timeline on the basis of feeling the pressure to get things done by a specific date, or are you absolutely sure you can accommodate everything within this time frame and go through robust consultation and feedback and amendment and so on? Because my fear is that all of our reputations are on the line if we have further slippage. Mm. So I would rather that we had a very known and timeline that can accommodate some slippage and some subjects along the way. So.
Well, the answer to this is actually this is a best case scenario. So it's not a timeline that allows for any slippage. And I hear what you're saying about better be safe than sorry. But on the other hand, there is a second round of public consultation within this timeline, if second means after the one we had in December. We have a public consultation here. We don't have two public consultations.
Okay. Have you given any thought to a worst-case timeline? And if you have, could you share it with us?
Well, we haven't made a worst case, but we made a one if we needed room for slippage. And we actually decided not to publish it because we think that we really want to try and accomplish this timeline. We want to go for this. And there are two reasons, and one is trying to, you know, get things done and not get too much into fatigue in the working group by prolonging this in too long time. And the other one is, well, we think it might be a dangerous signal to to have two timelines. So kind of which one do we believe in? So
I think the point that's of paramount importance to me is that, you know, we all recognize that we're dealing on a limited timeline and a limited window of opportunity for the transition to occur. But I think we also have to ensure that what we're doing is right individually and collectively within each of the groups. So getting it right rather than getting it done by a date is important. But because of the already impossible deadlines having been breached, what I'd rather do is that we all have realistic timelines to work to that we know can accommodate some issues along the way than to neglect to fulfil all the T crossing and I dotting that is essential on this path.
Well, I agree that we need realistic timelines. I don't think this is unrealistic. There are some risk factors that are incorporated in it, and if they are actually affecting this, we might slip. But we're, well, working on this, we're trying to actually do our best to accomplish this, and we're in the group, we're thinking of changing the way of working methods, so in order to accomplish more and different. So I'm not as pessimistic as you are on not meeting the new timeline, but I know it's gonna be a tough spring, but this is actually what we're trying to accomplish. Yeah. Any more questions on this? No, I appreciate it now, so it's fine. And if you have questions along the presentation, just feel free to ask. We might. Yeah, I want to go back. So this discussion document is actually one of our one of our tools to try and find a way forward on this working group. And we thought it would be very good to have a document that were not very long, not very detailed, but explain the models in a few words, even though they're pretty many words of some slides. But if we start with the next slide and see the two main models, that's the external versus the internal ICANN model. And we tried to build those models on a fundamental principle of what is going to replace NTIA as a body. And you can have the external replacement or you can have the internal. One of the common features of both models, and that's very important to underline, is that we have the separability as a common feature for both models. And we kind of sense that sensibility is going to be an issue for this working group and also for the communities. And, separability is dealt with differently in the external model versus the internal. But in the external model, the replacement entity cannot be ICANN, but ICANN would be granted the contract for the IANA functions post-transition of this entity. And this is because we all recognize that ICANN is doing a good job, and there is no one who really wants to separate ICANN at the moment. So the both model includes ICANN as it is today within or IANA as it is today within ICANN. Whereas the internal model is that the NTIA would transition its functions to ICANN, and they would continue to operate IANA but without a contract. Next slide, please. So what are the common points between those two models? Well, both models have a kind of a multi-stakeholder review team. The external model would have a creation of a new multi-stakeholder review team, whereas the internal would have ICANN maybe doing a separate entity within ICANN, or it can be a working group. There's many ways this could be done. Both are in favor of a customer standing committee. That is a small group of people that oversees the IANA performance. That's the technical day-to-day stuff, measuring their performance. We have the independent appeals panel, and I know this is an issue for many CCs. And this is going to be discussed hopefully on Tuesday. And there is also some thoughts about having this divided into that the CCs are going to put in their wishes for how an IAP should be, and you have the GTLDs that are much more relaxed about this because they have a very well-defined procedure within ICANN. Last, we have separability again, not meaning that the IANA function should be transferred from ICANN from the beginning, but there is this option to do so and in the future. And this is where we try to stress that this option to separate IANA from ICANN should only be an extreme case. So it's not going to be easy to do. It's going to be of a severe malfunction or a severe breach of any contract or SLA. Next slide, please. So if we go through the external models, we have the contract co, where the authority is the multi-stakeholder community, the MRT. You have a contract co that's supposed to be a small, lightweight company, which main responsibility is to hold the contract with ICANN and regarding the IANA functions. And if ICANN would breach this contract, the contract co and the multi-stakeholder review team could select a new operator. As it says, the MRT is likely to be a committee of contract co, and the CSC is, the CSC is going to be a small group of people that are very focused on the performance. And so IAP is also as described in the prior model. Okay, next slide, please. We have an external trust model. It's a little different, where the contract co, instead of being a company, is taking the form of a trust. And the trust will have a board of trustees. The trustees would also be selected from the multi-stakeholder community. And the trust would receive an assignment from NTIA, and their duties included its stewardship role. Yeah?
Just curious as to your take on this. How does it really differ in any meaningful way than in the external contract co in terms of addressing some of the perceived issues that those who aren't necessarily favorable to structural change?
Alan must correct me if I'm wrong here, but the trust is different, that it's a different legal entity than a contract co. A contract co, I think it's easier to have the capture issue, and it's not as easy. It might, or you can correct me, Nigel, but this, I think the main purpose was that a trust is more safe, and it's more difficult to change its bylaws and change its purpose.
So recognizing the different legal structures, I guess my question was more for those
perception for those who would not be supportive of structural separation, is there much of a difference?
Well, I think that just spins it into a very long discussion, so I'm going to ignore that. I'm sorry, Byron. I want to keep it to the 30-second model. I think there's a danger of walking into some very, very deep water when talking about trusts in this context for two reasons. First of all, U.S. law and trusts are something that is quite deep water. There's lots of examples in U.S. law of courts looking through trusts as if they don't exist, which is not the case in other common law jurisdictions that specialize in trusts, like where I come from. Also, most of the European civilized world doesn't recognize trusts at all. It's either a civil law or a Roman law-based system, and trusts do not apply. A trust isn't a separate legal entity. It isn't a legal entity at all. It's transferring property from one owner to another legal owner for the benefit of a third party. That's what a trust is. And only in certain countries where they have created things called purpose trusts specifically in legislation can you have a trust for a purpose. Otherwise, you can't have a trust for a purpose. You have to have a trust for property. It's very deep. I happen to have specialized in this, but it's very, very deep. It could work, but I think in the context of ICAM, when we have all these different legal systems, we have these different concepts, just simply explaining what it is to most people is going to be hard. And then you turn around and say, well, you said U.S. law, that. Oh, no thanks.
Well, I think we have to explore different models. That's the first reply. And the other reply is we're trying to seek legal advice on this, and that's very important to keep in mind. We haven't gotten this legal advice. We're going to get it on both models. So we're trying to keep too much of the legal discussion out of this until we get someone who are deeply knowledgeable about this to give us some advice. And regarding your question, is it going to make a difference for people if it's a trust or a contract co? I don't know. I don't think so, but we, as I say, we're exploring. And I don't think we should rule anything out yet. Let's go with the different models. Okay? Yeah, next one. I just lost the Adobe room, so... Can I look at your Adobe room? Okay, yes. And then we have the internal bylaw model where the authority is that the IANA functions are transferred to ICANN after it has amended its bylaws. There's going to create a golden bylaw that cannot be unilaterally amended by the ICANN board. So this bylaw would guarantee that the right to perform IANA functions could be relinquished if required so by the multi-stakeholders. I have it now, thank you. And, well, the separation of IANA would require the creation of a contract co later on or a trust later on if that would. Well, the MRT and the CSC, the MRT could be additional bylaw modifications, creating a standing committee. And the CSC is very similar as described before, and so the IAP would also require some bylaw changes. Next slide, please. And then you have the internal trust model. And then again, the transition from NTIA would require a declaration of trust And it doesn't need to be a necessarily a separate company or entity to be a legally valid instrument, but there would be a guardian of the trust. That would be preferably the cross-community group, similar to the MRT. And the guardian would also have the authority to escalate processes if anything is complained about IANA, and the declaration of trust would codify the membership responsibilities and operating procedures of the MRT. And the CSC and IAP is similar. The IAP needs bylaw changes too. So these are the models. And next slide, I think it's the questions. No, that's the timeline we've been here. And the last slides are, all the questions are not here, but they're in the document. We send out questions regarding the discussion documents, and we really hope that the communities can have input for us by Thursday, where we have a Q&A session where we're going to take some of the issues, discuss some of the issues that the community has with the different proposals.
Are there any questions for Lise right here, right now, or input and feedback? Keith? And then Nigel.
Could we go back to page 6 and the appeals authority, independent appeals panel and so on. Where do you foresee the redelegations and delegations requests for CCTLDs coming from? Would it all be within the current mechanism of the ICANN board decisions? And is the IAP the appeals authority that a redelegation might be reheard through as per RFC 1591 requirements, as the appeals mechanism for that instance?
Well, actually, I don't foresee that the IAP should deal with the delegation, redelegation politics. This is only going to be procedure. Has procedure been followed? And I think this is going to apply to that you have the framework of interpretation doing some work that's going to be guiding the IAP.
Okay, one of the recommendations of the Framework of Interpretation Working Group is for the establishment of the appeals mechanism under RFC 1591. It may be a consideration that your committee could give to whether or not there should be or whether or not that appeals panel or some other mechanism should be enabled to hear those redelegations.
Well, actually, the idea is to ask the CC community and using the framework of interpretation on this. And I think it's very important that we get the input on what are the wishes for an IAP from the CC community, because we are very diverse in what do we think it should be doing and what it shouldn't be doing, if apart from the GTLDs. So I hope that we get a thorough discussion on this on Tuesday, because we're having the IAP as a sole issue just to get this input.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Nigel?
Yeah, without going into the technicalities, I see the internal trust model to be even more problematic. The third point down said it would be a legally enforceable, I forget the expression that was used on the slide, instrument or something like that. No, it wouldn't. You couldn't do that under trust law.
So I know that the CWG is actually just about to engage legal consultants to actually answer a number of these or give guidance
lawyers never actually answer the question, but give guidance on some of these very specific and technical questions. But that hasn't been done yet, is my understanding, right?
We actually have a client committee of our group where we are four people, Greg Shatton and Martin Simon and the co-chairs. And we're there's been a document sent out, a legal scoping document that we're sending out to the different legal companies, and we're in contact of getting, I don't know if it's a bidding, but we're trying to find a legal company that can kind of ask all those questions. So they have to have a certain size because they need to be knowledgeable about non-profit and trust law. And so we are really looking and...
It depends what question you ask them, and it depends what jurisdiction you ask them the question in. In the U.S., you've got 50 to choose from, and you will get different answers depending whether you pick California, New York, Delaware, or wherever.
Well, the internal model is actually going to be California law you ask about, because that's going to be ICANN, right? So, and that's California law. So that part is pretty set. And we figure it's going to be a dialogue. It's not going to be only questions. It's going to be actual consultation on as an ongoing process.
So I'm going to start to wind this section up so that we can go to the CCWG, but then I'm going to give you both a little bit of forewarning. I'm certainly going to ask, and I'm sure others may, what the interrelationship is between the two, whether you're talking, how you're coordinating. When we saw that eye-busting chart up there, I'd like to get some feedback on that. So you can think about that over the next few minutes. Carolina, last question to you, and then we'll put you on the floor.
Oh, okay. It's a question as well, and I had an exchange with Peter last night regarding this issue. There are these nine questions that came out of Bard's document after the webinars this week, which I thought they were very interesting, and they helped this community think about the process. And although I still feel they are very relevant questions, I was wondering, I mean, when you ask, for example, do you believe that a transition from the NTIA should happen? I mean, are we ready as a community to take this, to take feedback, I mean, general feedback saying, no, we don't think the NTIA should be replaced? I mean, is it the right moment to ask this kind of questions now? And because I think that we might be expecting, I don't know what are the expectations of the CWG in this respect, or for example, the idea that there would be other transition models which the CWG should be exploring. I mean, okay, that might be a question that we might be ready at this stage, but I think that, I mean, being an observer in this group and reading the documents, I think we are already far away in the process where we do have two models and where we are working on a scheme where the NTIA will be replaced. So I think that these questions are vital, they are essential. I really like them, and I really use them in my community and translated them into Spanish so that they could be really thinking about these issues for this week. But I would be afraid, I mean, if there would be some comments coming at this stage which might be a little bit... quite different, or that they might sort of blow the whole thing up. So what is the CWG thinking in that respect?
Well, regarding the first question, should the transition happen, that was more, we kind of sense some traction from some of the communities, not some of the communities, for some people on this. And I think it's very important to get the overview. Is there a resistance against the transition as a general idea, or where are the different stakeholders? So So that was one of them. The other one is we're actually, even though we've been narrowing down on two principal models, I think it's very important to keep asking, are we looking broadly enough on solutions? Do you have a very good idea that we haven't explored? So I think at this stage we have some entities that I think would be in any model, but could we have an alternative that we haven't discovered? So that's I hope not, but we want to keep an open mind.
Thank you. And the very last question goes to Mathieu.
Just to make sure you can ask questions when I'm introducing as well. No, I think from a very CCTLD-centric perspective, there are two questions that tend to be put aside in the presentations we're seeing on the CWG. And one is, is there still someone who just rubber stamps anything coming from IANA towards VeriSign in the proposals, or is there a consensus emerging on whether it disappears or is it still here? And the second is, what happens with the root zone management contract? Because we are all, I mean, as a CCTLD manager, my concern is, how long are changes going to take? Is it going to be predictable, and so on and so forth? So the policy doesn't change, but the transition, the NTIA role is changing. And I haven't seen a lot of communication about what the CWG thinks happens with this process.
Well, actually, you haven't seen a lot of communication yet, because we need, as part of the RFP, there are certain steps, and step three is to find a proposal. Step four is what are the implications, and I think the implications is going to be part of that analysis. So until we find which model we go for, we can't do the implication analysis. And then you have to do an analysis. Have we fulfilled all the conditions by the NTIA, and what has been the involvement of the multi-stakeholder community? So these three parts, RFP 4 to 6, we have kind of put to a standstill. RFP 4 are kind of working still, but not at the speed that you want. So you can't get that part yet, but... We need to conclude on a way to go before we do the other one, because otherwise we're going to do four implication analysis and three will be lost. We're only going to put forward one model.
Now to the CCWG one. So some of you may get lost in the acronyms and the groups. No, that doesn't happen here. So the CCWG is the late starter group. Started, I think, endorsement of charter was beginning of December. So we really started working around Christmas. Perfect time to start a working group. And the idea was that this particular group was a reaction from the community that said, by addressing the IANA specific issues, we're not fully taking into account the fact that the U.S. government has always been the last stop, the last accountability mechanism for ICANN overall. And so the scope of the CCWG is very much focused about how ICANN itself is accountable, with a very, very simple goal, enhance ICANN's accountability to a level where people are comfortable that the transition can take place. So I'm trying to remember the first slides and do them by heart. So that's the scope. It is structured around two work streams. The work stream one is basically what needs to be in place or committed to before the INR transition takes place. And then there's work stream two, which can capture other accountability enhancements that may take place after the transition. That's the way it was set up. After two public comments, various interesting discussions with management about how to organize the process, including input from the CCNSO at both consultations. And it started in December, I've said that already. It's a very large group, 165 members and participants, five chartering organizations, the CCNSO, of course, the GNSO, the GAC, ALAC, and ASO as well. SSAC said it would follow from afar but did not have the resources to engage more. And we have two liaisons from the ICG and a board liaison as well, who is Bruce Tonkin, a staff liaison, Sam Eisner from the legal department, and an ATRT, a past review team member, who is Avery Doria. So that's the scope of the group. There's been one face-to-face meeting so far in Frankfurt, mid-January, and weekly conference calls and all the rest, the usual stuff. And hundreds of emails, so tons of emails. Tons of email, if you want my opinion. Too many emails, anyway. Everything being transparent, and everything. You can't load it. Okay. So, I'm starting to get familiar with this presentation, so I think I can give it without slides anyway. First thing we've set up to do was clarify definitions. And as you can imagine, accountability is quite difficult to define. People have different ways of seeing accountability. For some people, the very fact that you give advance warning of a meeting is accountability. For others, it's restricted to very strong decisions. So we've had a number of discussions. And there's a very interesting paper, I think, currently being reviewed by external experts. You remember the experts, the discussions there was about external experts, and it was settled that the public experts group appoints experts, external experts, to the CCWG, and I think six of them are now appointed, and they can review documents, provide input that has to be considered. It's fair to say they are not fully engaged with the group yet. And so the system we were aiming at in the CCNSO, which was to have advisors that actually provide advice and input on best practice, I don't think we're there at all, and we probably won't be, except for maybe one or two advisors who might be more interested. The time commitment is too limited for that. And I can refuse to actually consider these advisors as people you have to pay for. And so we have the time commitment that goes for volunteer work. So definitions, the key questions we've raised are accountable, yes. Accountable for what? For what purpose should I can be accountable? So there's four items. Respecting due process. Respecting applicable laws in jurisdictions where I can operate, and that includes internationally agreed laws. Nigel, we've had the discussion about the things I will not name.
Third is accountable to specific levels of performance and security. Of course, that's very relevant for IANA and for us. And accountable so that the decisions that are made for the interest of the wider stakeholders and not just for a particular set of stakeholders within EAT. You can have a captured organization that still takes that in mind and is accountable to that. Well, that is not by itself an issue. It's not being captured, it's the decision you make that are an issue. There are CCTLDs who are totally in the hands of one particular stakeholder, and maybe they act in an accountable way anyway. So that's the distinction I'm making. So that's the purpose of accountability. So obviously in this fourth area was our way to find common ground on the discussions regarding public interest, which cannot be defined, and that's an issue, and so on. So that's the purpose of accountability. What is accountability is the second section. So accountability goes from transparency, consultation, checks and balances, review, redress, and independence. Those are the different items. The main discussion there was about review versus redress. Basically, the outcome is redress is when the outcome of the decision is binding. Review is when we review how the CCNSO is working and we provide recommendations, and then we're free to do what we want with that. And the assessment is basically that for the board, there's not a lot of redress. Excellent. So can we move on a few slides? Let me purpose and... Oh, that's a nice one. Okay, so that's where we are. Other key discussion is independence. And I expect the GAC is going to be looking at this one very, very closely. And we need to be aware that as multi-stakeholder organization, it's difficult to be absolutely independent and in a multi-stakeholder organization, as the principle is that stakeholders have a stake and participate to the decisions. And that's where we all try to find balance. The next slide. And then there was the discussion about to whom should I can be accountable. And it's probably to everyone being affected by ICANN's decisions. So us, the CCTLD managers, the registrars, the right owners, etc., but also the people who are not within the ICANN setup but who are affected by these decisions, including CCTLD registrars. Some of our registrars, for those of us who have registrars, are not ICANN accredited registrars, and yet the way ICANN is shaping the registrar business has a strong influence on them. So that's with discussion. On the next slide is the affecting parties, and that's basically everyone. And questions? Yeah, feel free to interrupt.
Peter Harrison from Center. Mathieu, my question actually dates back from, I think, two or three slides ago, where you have independence and I can't remember what the other word was that was in there.
One before?
So linking back to the directly affected parties. So it's, yes, it's this slide. So independence, and then the next one, directly affected parties. Is that a point where you see conflict or for which we want to prepare when, on the one hand, as a CCNSO, we expect the councillors that we have elected to represent our interests, and on the other hand, we expect them to or at least all the others need to be completely independent from any interest groups. How do you see that conflict? Is that something we should prepare for in the coming discussions?
I think we should prepare for a generic discussion regarding how you can be accountable, so including an independence part, in a multi-stakeholder organization where those people who are affected also participate in the decision directly. So how can you build a system that is where everyone co-organizes the decisions without getting into the lack of independence issue? And what saves, what will probably save this discussion is that independence is not black and white. It's never black and white. It's always something along a certain line, and it's a light gray or darker gray. And what happens in general in organization, and especially in within when you set up a board for a public company, well, you set up a requirement that a certain number of people in the board are independent, and you define independence. And even the definition of independence is not black and white. It's whether or not your judgment will be affected by your material interests outside of the company. So it's really a judgment call. And that's where, I mean, that's something we can improve, but never create the perfect system. The perfect independent expert is the one who knows nothing. And I think that would be the problem. So it's just improving this, which will be probably in question. And the GAC is going to be very careful about this. But very sensitive. It's a sensitive issue for many GAC members. Conflicts of interest and independence and capture and everything.
I just would note that there are fairly well-known, well-established, and globally accepted concepts of independence with respect to sort of judicial functions, and that's really what we're talking about. So it's a combination of the economic interest and, you know, personal interest and all of those things. So I don't think we have to reinvent the wheel here because it is pretty globally recognized standard.
So I think that's all for definitions. So what's the purpose? What is accountability? And to whom should I can be accountable? That is a draft document currently being reviewed. And hopefully I think it's pretty stable now. So then we, one important aspect we have in our work, can we go to next slides, please, Bart? Next one? Yes. As you may be aware, there was a lot of emphasis being put, especially by Larry Strickling, on the fact that the outcome of the proposals had to be stress-tested. And so we very early we started working on contingencies that would be used for those stress tests. And we have a list of 25 contingencies grouped into five categories that we are currently using we're currently developing the stress tests themselves to see how they apply to the current situation first. So the five categories are, what if there is a financial crisis and I can or becomes insolvent? What if there's no money left in a bank? What if ICANN does not meet its operational obligations? What if there is legal action or legislative action against ICANN or that affects ICANN's policies or ways to operate? What if internally there is a failure in the accountability mechanisms? What if the CEO becomes crazy?
never happened before. And what if ICANN fails to be accountable to external stakeholders? And what we're trying to develop around the stress test is explain how it happens, what are the consequences, and how the existing or future accountability mechanisms will help mitigate those risks, if they are able to mitigate, and maybe some of these contingencies we will not be able to mitigate. And that's a most probable outcome. But at least we'll have a structured way to explain how our proposals improve ICANN's accountability in the light of these specific 25 contingencies.
Next slide, Bart.
So we're getting into the core now, and that's really what we've been working on in Frankfurt. Our goal in the face-to-face meeting was to come out with clear definition of what was expected to work through Workstream 1. And there are two different package of requirements. So we're not working on solutions, we're working on requirements. We're doing the other way around, intentionally, because we know solutions get people embarked into details. And so there are two different groups of things, enabling the empowerment, and it's an interesting one, enabling communication empowerment, that's community empowerment, over the board decisions within a limited, strictly enumerated last resort powers. Those are very important ones, and I'll come back to this, and enhancing the review and redress processes. So next slide is going to give more details. So the first one, the first package is community empowerment. So what we mean by that is providing the community, we don't know yet what it is and how it's working. There are five or six different options on the table to do a number of things that provide either review or checks and balances or redress towards the board decisions. So the community would be able to approve the strategic plan, the budget, probably the accounts as well. Wouldn't be good. Wouldn't be bad to approve the accounts. Approve any change to the bylaws. Approve if the board was to act against the bylaws, the community could be able to ask for reconsideration. Refer a specific decision to the ICANN board or to a panel for reconsideration or invalidate a decision, and remove one or more members of the board if they were behaving badly. So there are many options being discussed at this stage around this, and that's one of the aspects we've asked legal advice on. To see what's possible, not possible, around requirements. And our goal is to ask lawyers not, is it possible, but how can we make this happen? Which is, I mean, experience with lawyers. Two of my co-chairs are lawyers. That helps. So those are really, the idea behind this is those are the typical checks that members of a member organization have above a board, even in a corporation, even in international organization, that happens. And this morning we had a meeting with the board, and Shireen said something that he was very surprised because it made sense. I don't know how to take this remark, actually. Was puzzled. Anyway, this is, and it's last resort. It's on certain decisions and not all of them, because it's certainly not the intention to block or paralyze the board. The second group of things is review and redress, and enhancing the review and redress processes. And enhancements go from increasing independence, providing them with real redress powers, incorporating the affirmation of commitment into the bylaws is one of the enhancements that's been considered. And if you have more questions, Becky is leading this one. So I should note that CCTLDs are particularly engaged in this group. So Becky is going to be rapporteur for Work Party 1, Work Party 2, Jordan for Work Party 1. I mean, significant commitment and implication of CCTLDs. But also Becky is a GNSO member, I think, in this group, right? Yeah. You're in your...
My heart is always as a CC.
Your heart belongs to us.
That's not what you were saying to GSO this morning. So those are the two building blocks that, in our mind, creates the minimum accountable system for the transition to happen. And before I go to the unreadable timeline, I think I should stress that what we're looking for here in Singapore is feedback from the various communities, whether we're forgetting something, whether it makes sense, whether it's too far outreaching, and of course, if there are any things we should be aware of to amend. That's really our key expectation from engagement with the community this week. The next slide is the timeline, I think. Yes. Very, very aggressive one. And we never forget we are driven by the quality of the proposals first, the timing second. But we have the timing into our heart, so it's a best-case scenario. And we are very much communicating with Lisa and Jonathan about this. And actually, this timeline was designed with them with a lot of interaction between us as co-chair levels. So this timeline goes through an approval by Buenos Aires, by the board. Very, very aggressive, because that means the SONACs would have to approve before. There needs to be a public comment. It might happen at the same time as the CWG public comment. Can the community cope with that? We don't know yet. We also need legal advice, independent legal advice. So independent being probably not John's day, probably not a legal advice from a regular contributor to the to ICANN, but not to other significant industry players either. We don't want the legal advisors from VeriSign to provide us with legal advice. That would have no more value than Jones Day. So that's a one of the big struggles that the CWG and us are coordinating about, to get that independent legal advice funded by ICANN. In our group, there was talk about crowdfunding this, actually, within the groups. I mean, a number of members in our group said, oh, okay, I can put some dollars on the table, and, I mean, we're 170, and if 30 of us put a bit of money, we can get decent legal advice. But, of course, ICANN is facilitating the process, and so my personal view is that they have to fund this. It's part of their mission as defined by the NTIA in the transition. So legal advice is one aspect. Endorsement by SONACs between sessions is going to be a big challenge. Imagine the challenge for the GAC. I mean, endorsing something is already an issue. Between sessions, that's just like, well, you never know. A miracle can happen. So it's very aggressive here. And I think that covers it. I don't think, is there a next slide? I think the next slide is a conclusion. Yeah, you have everything. The working we have two working sessions this week, one on Monday late afternoon, one on Thursday very early morning, and one engagement session on Wednesday, unfortunately conflicting with the CC, and a session in the CCNSO on Wednesday afternoon. And we've already met with the GAC and board this morning. That's it on my side.
Any questions or feedback from Ezio at this point? Keith?
Thank you, Matthew. It's really the same question I asked Lisa just before in terms of her working group. You talk about the timeline, the unreadable timeline, but you too have said this is the best case scenario. Maybe I could re-put the question to Lisa as well. If the worst case scenario applied, how much extra time would you need, or are you really comfortable that you can achieve your best case timeline?
I guess a way to answer is no, I'm not really comfortable that we can meet the best case timeline. And I don't know what the worst case would be, but I guess the worst case would be that we're not able to deliver anything. And so I think it's definitely not the worst case that we would shift a little bit this timeline. Because what really matters in the end is that we demonstrate we can come up with a proposal, we can find consensus on the CWG, and we can come up with proposals that can be implemented pretty quickly within ICANN to improve accountability. I'm confident we can do that. I mean, I'm more confident for our group than for Lisa's. I think the challenge on the CWG is currently very much higher. I think we can achieve that. And whether it be, a first way to shift would be that the process to consider the proposals by the SO and ACs would be in Buenos Aires. So that's a shift by, I don't know, three to four weeks. And I think that would be more reasonable. But then there would be the question about when the board considers and everything. But that would be my plan A plus, whatever. Is that a good answer to your question?
We haven't made a worst case scenario either, so it's and I still Mathieu, we're not absolutely sure we're going to make the best case, but I'm not confident, but I'm striving to do so.
Okay. The follow-up to that, of course, too, is that while you may develop consensus within your respective working groups and make that deadline, it's also really, really important that we carry our entire community with this. Well, the last thing any of us wants is a group of CCTLDs coming in at transition or the date that it's due to go to the ICANN board and say, we weren't properly consulted, we're not part of the consensus mechanism, we don't like this, and we want something else. So being conscious of that process, I recognise both of you have your consultation processes, but please be urged not to skimp on the outreach and getting the message, the communications out to the edge all the time through the process. Thank you.
I just want to comment that one of our key dependencies are actually the sign-off of the chartering organizations, and I know you're also talking about the outreach of the non-CCNSO members, and we're very aware of this, but it's a fine balance of getting the important stuff out and not sending too much out, because people get tired of getting emails all the time, and We're trying to have those webinars all the time, and we see some new attendants every time, and we keep track of who are attending. Do we see new people there? So we have focus on this, and I agree it's very, very important that we don't have someone coming in the end saying, I wasn't aware. Why wasn't I informed?
I think, though, even within the CCNSO and the regular attendees, despite the discussions that have occurred so far, there seems to be a relatively low level of interest in what is the most critical thing the CCs have individually faced since the inception of ICANN. Again, I'm hoping that we'll see a different attitude because of the dominance of the agenda being on the IANA transition here in Singapore this time. So hopefully there'll be more buy-in from CCs, and that will cause more discussion through the regional organisations and so on. But, to me, I'm still a little surprised at the lack of real buy-in by everybody.
Peter?
I think Keith touches upon a crucial topic, and that is the interest and the interaction on this topic with the CCs. As we've already expressed on previous calls at CCNSO Council, regional organizations are struggling with that. While the numbers are still looking okay-ish, those numbers do not reflect the number of people that actually understand what they're listening into during those webinars. Some of the conversation that I have had with members that I would assume are well informed about what's happening because they're playing significant roles in some of the debates, actually shows still an enormous lack of understanding. Not just about the processes, but also about the underlying mechanisms. Believe it or not, but it is still an issue that some people do not know what IANA is doing. And we can keep on feeding them the diagrams, and IANA already did a good job, but I think it's still relevant and still timely to have a joint outreach effort in that area. It is frustrating to keep on producing summaries of what's happening, and still we are asked by our members to simplify it a couple of steps more. I mean, if we go further down that road, then I have to ask my four-year-old to start making drawings. Even the diagrams that we put on our last update, which was a visual update of the process, apparently scared some people away. One of the things I think we should be cautious about is that we should not give people the impression that we or somebody somehow will be able to make this a no-brain effort. It is a difficult topic, and people need to realize that they will have to spend time on it. And if it's the first time that they'll be looking at it, that time will be a couple of hours. But we should not give them the impression that through a CCNSO discussion on accountability on Wednesday, they will walk away understanding the whole thing and being able to express an opinion on it. That will not happen. So two follow-ups from this. Can we do a joint effort? We're bringing this to the table of the ISTAR organizations as well. I'm not sure whether that will make any difference, but we'll see. So can we do this, a joint effort, CCNSO and regional organizations on education? And secondly, can we agree on the message that people will need to start putting in some time on this?
Some very good points, Peter. I think we are at the end of our time because we do need to talk a little bit about how, at least start to talk about how might we be making this decision whenever a decision point arrives. Is everybody okay with moving on to that? So first off, thank you, Mathieu and Lise, for joining us. I think you're welcome to stay for this next part because it is about how do we actually make this decision. And you can put your CC manager hats on for this.
So I thought it would be good to start thinking about how we will come to a decision at whatever point the questions arrive at our door. And to that end, I have put together some slides, but really just to stimulate some thinking and discussion around how we're going to come to this conclusion. And this is a conversation not meant to be a presentation per se, but there are some words on the slides that hopefully will catalyze some thinking about how we're going to get to this. So if we could just to lay some of the groundwork, obviously the IANA transition proposal needs CCNSO approval, and we were one of the chartering organizations, so of course it is. We own this in a very meaningful way, and it does have to come to the CCNSO for approval to proceed. We will also be asked to approve the CCWG's work, and as we've heard a little bit about in terms of timing, the time is very short. So without restating what we've already heard, we will have not much time to actually come to the decision once the final outputs are presented to us. I do think there is still a bit of a, from everything I've heard, a sliding timeline ahead of us. It's coming into focus, but it is certainly not crisply in focus. And I would suggest, you know, just thinking out loud, that we will likely need another face-to-face meeting in BA to really make it possible for the CCNSO to come to a conclusion. Even if that, but another face-to-face meeting. That's just talking amongst us friends here, but that's what it feels like to me. If we go to the next slide. I think another important point here is the top bullet point, which is it's quite possible that the CWG will ask us in the CCNSO to make some kind of conditional approval based on accountability tracks work, and that's why it's so important for us to understand the linkages in terms of how those two groups are actually working and when their outputs may come, how simultaneously or how far apart those outputs may come. And I really just put this forward to flag it as certainly a possibility. I would say it's a suboptimal outcome if we were asked to do something like that, but it remains within the realm of possibility that we would have to consider the CWG's work before we crisply understood the CCWG's work. And as a result, what is our decision-making process going to look like? And we've heard Peter made, and others have made some good points about when do we know we've got enough feedback and consensus to actually start to make that decision? Because I think we also have to accept the fact that we can lead the horse to water, we can drag the horses to water, kicking and resisting and claiming ignorance, and there's no way we can make them drink. We can barely get them to come to the pond, to beat this metaphor to death. And at some point, we will have to accept that to be the case and accept what level we can be comfortable with that at. And there are some who are probably truly going to be, and I don't say this in a disparaging way, but ignorant of what's happening here, and there are some who will be willfully and proactively ignorant and claim such. And we are going to have, I think, the stomach to accept a certain level of that and still make a decision. We need to be ready for that. But what is that approval process going to be? What is that number going to be? Are we going to know it when we see it? Do we want to go in saying we need X? Keith?
Just on that point, it does raise to me the issue of both the accountability and CWG IANA teams having a you know, or keeping a record, a matrix of the attempts to outreach and so on, so that if there is that kind of negative feedback at the end, we can actually demonstrate exactly what we had done. So rather than trying to reconstruct that at the end, it's probably quite a good idea to be proactively keeping that. Yeah, good.
It's definitely happening. I think we're probably at a point where we should be publishing it, because it's one thing for a few people very close to it to have that matrix or record and know it's happening, but to make it very broadly available so the whole community can start to see what the outreach has been and that it has been substantive is important. Could you go to the next slide? And Peter?
Peter from Center. I understand the implications of being a chartering organization, but exactly because what we're trying to cover is at least a broader scope than just CCNSO members, is this a point in time where we start thinking on how we're going to include their opinion into the CCNSO approval process? Obviously, there will be no formal way of doing so, but how can we cover for those? We would not be taking into account, for instance, Lisa's opinion, if we're looking at the CCNSO approval process.
Well, and I think, you know, there's some interesting questions around that thought, because, you know, I know and we know there are some CCTLDs who will absolutely resist participating in the process because they are trying to make the point that they're not bound by ICANN and will not participate forcefully in order to say that whatever the end result is does not apply to them.
Sure, but that would not stop us from taking their public opinion into account. If we know that, I'm sorry to keep from using a U.S. example, that Lisa supports Model A, B, or well, if she supports Model A, then the approval process and the CCNSO could take that into account. Not saying that she would endorse any outcome of the CCNSO, but to make sure that to the rest of the world it's also clear that we have broadly consulted and we know what's going on in the 180 CCs that are not member of the CCNSO.
I agree. We have to bring them in somehow. Carolina? And it hasn't been without trying. I mean, we do use the CCTLD list. There has certainly been outreach. All are welcome to the webinars, et cetera.
It's interesting to see how the ICG and several RFPs within the CWG have been going back to this word consensus. I mean, using the definitions that these different groups have sort of recovered from the origins of the early engineers, I mean, that is the only, I would say, legitimate mechanism that the CCNSO would have in a way to sort of sense what where the ball is actually when the time comes. The council will vote, but I mean, in order to sense what the other CCTLDs, whether they are or not institutionalized within the CCNSO or the ROs, I mean, it's just a matter of consensus, and we have to, my opinion is that they have to be very much aware how consensus works and what does it actually mean to reach a decision by consensus.
I think that, so that's exactly the kind of conversation that I want to stimulate here. I mean, that, how do we come to rough consensus and running code? You know, where do we define the line of we can make that decision? And, you know, let's just put it on the table, is a TLD with 10 or 15 million domains under management have one vote the same as a TLD with 5,000 names under management? How do we unpack that? You know, you get to some delicate areas when you talk about decision making here, and I think we need to be
relatively crisp on how we're going to come to that. And I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm just, those are some of the issues we're going to have to face.
I'm not a CCNSO counselor, but I'd like to offer two thoughts. One regarding one CCTLD, one vote. I would caution against going into a voting type of consultation. The only voting system you have is a CCNSO council voting system. And I think what matters is defining the criteria, the red lines, in terms of the overall objectives that the CCNSO might have. Security, stability, performance, whatever they are. And including the fact that maybe if one single CCTLD with a particular, if one single CCTLD's refusal of the model threatens the security and stability of the overall model, that should be a concern. If it's I'm in or I'm out or I'm not in favor, but it's not threatening some of the core aspects, and it's just about who's right or wrong, then it's not the same thing. So that's the first stuff. And second is about how to engage globally and make sure it is recognized that the CCNSO decision took into account everyone's input. In the ICANN board, you have the whereas. If you're able to demonstrate that you proactively engaged and that you recognize in the whereas section of your decision that you have received from LACTLD a comment that covers that many CCTLDs and that is a position that is maybe even diverse, and same for center and same for others, and including some individual ones, then I think you've done everything you could. And anyway, the CCTLD community is going to hold you accountable. You won't escape that.
Yang'am?
Thanks, Baron Yang Li. As to your question about how do we approve, my thinking is basically very similar to Carolina's in that I don't think we should the word approve doesn't appropriately describe what we should be doing. If we are going to have only 3 weeks until the final proposal comes out, we're not just going to have the 3 weeks. We are going to have the weeks leading to it, engaging in it, and hearing the reports from the CWG and the CCWG, and making our opinions known. But as you said, there are going to, if we think back to Net Mundial, we can assume that some countries will not want ICANN to continue the way it has. But on the other side, because we know, we have a general idea of what those countries are or what those players are, I think just leading to the process, we should try to encourage especially those countries or those CCs that to participate more and to get them to voice their opinions more. I think that's just I mean, but as for the CCNSO council vote, it's not binding. I don't think that's, I mean, it can be a general statement about the general feeling of the CCs, but I don't think it can be binding to other CCs. But once this transition is done, it will be binding to almost all the players. And so it's not the CC vote that mandates it. It's participation in the process and the process itself that actually validates itself. So how to approve is, I think we just need to try to include the voices of those countries or those CCs that have not voiced their opinions yet more. Sorry, I don't have a clear opinion, but I think most of us feel this.
So I think many of the concepts you raise are valid. I mean, but I would challenge one in that as a chartering organization, we do have to approve by a vote of the council whether or not we approve the CWG and the CCWG's proposal. So from that perspective, we will have to vote on that. Now, how we get to that point, whether we are supportive of each of them or not, all of what you've just said is true. How do we bring the broader community in, the CCNSO membership, but the broad CCTLD community? How do we get a sense for that? And that's what I'm trying to unpack in terms of decision-making criteria. The technical vote at the end of that, yes, the council will have to vote up or down. How do we get to a point where we can look each other in the eye and our colleagues around the world in the eye and say, we believe what we're doing is consistent with the will of our community? That is a very challenging question. And if you look on the slide that Bart's just put up on engagement, you know, I think the CWG has gone to great lengths for outreach in terms of webinars, face-to-face, emails, CCTLD world list, out, you know, the ROs have done much work on this space. You know, lots of attempts have been made, and yet look at the engagement thus far. Only 13 of us as individual CCs actually put in a submission. I mean, not to belabor the fact, but there's more than that around this table, and we didn't even participate fully. Thankfully, the ROs put in, but again, only two of you put in submissions on behalf of your communities. So it is a very significant challenge, which clearly there's still much work to be done. And I think, I'm not going to speak for the working groups, but I'm sure either of them would be happy to have good ideas sent their way. But we are going to have to vote. Likely sometime in Buenos Aires, at the council meeting in Buenos Aires, timelines permitting. We'll send this deck out, because it also does speak to some of the technicalities of how the vote has to happen and some of the issues specifically behind the vote. And I would just ask you to take a look at it and continue to think about how we're going to get to the decision-making process, or how we know what the decision-making process is. We have to vote. How are we going to get to a place where we feel comfortable voting? Bart?
Just to add, so especially for you, Lisa, and for maybe for Mathieu as well, the real risk is if we do not run, if this not run properly, and that's what you see in one of those slides, a minority of the CCNSO members could ask for a vote. And if the CCNSO members ask for a vote and you don't have a quorum, that will take 2 or 3 months, and a quorum is applicable. So that will take, just the voting will take 3 months to get to the end result. That's the real risk involved in not checking and doing this properly.
And in the deck that we're going to send you, there is some of that information there.
Shall I explain it for you properly? It's in one of those slides. This is the normal CC&SO approval. You got, say, council decisions, but we have the rules of the CC&SO, which have been adopted in 2004, and they apply to every council decision except in over PDP, because that's regulated by bylaw. According to these rules, which are the internal rules of the CC&SO, 10% of the membership could ask for a vote to rectify the vote of council. Once this happens, if they ask for a vote, there will be a vote. So that means 16 CC&SO members can ask for a vote. That vote needs is a quorate vote. That means 50% plus one of the CC&SO members need to vote on the council decision. If they do not reach, if we do not reach that quorum, you go into a second round where there is just a voting majority counts.
Making sure I understand. First, there's a council vote. Then 16 members would challenge this decision. How does that take place? A joint letter or... Okay. And then there's a correct vote of the membership. Okay. Well, I think it's perfectly fair. There's deferral in the GNSO process, which is an option for members as well. All the SO and ACs have this. And everyone's aware of it. I mean, that's one way for to filibuster the whole process. Nothing to be done against it. That's probably worst case.
Carolina? They have 7 days from the point of the vote.
This, you could see it going back in time, say, with the finance working group, and the two of you were part of the finance working group. If you really look at the way it was structured at the time, council resolution was published, and it became effective 7 days after it was published. And that's precisely the window wherein 16 members can do it. And yeah, especially in this case, they will line up in case.
So this is a published, this is our process. We're not telling anything that none of us shouldn't have some grasp of, or we can at least go see the documentation. Mm. It's all there. But it just is a reminder of, even if we have a vote, there are a number of steps that could drag that on and delay it. Lise, I'm just being conscious of time. I'm going to give you the last word here.
It's just that it would be a problem if it takes 3 months, because that's going to, well, we're counting on 21 days. So I know that's very optimistic. So I understand the importance of keeping everyone as much in the loop as possible, so you get the sense of...
Yeah, it is. I think the real task is to avoid a members vote, because it's optional.
Okay, with that, I'm going to thank our guests. Thank you very much. You certainly have your work cut out for you. be the understatement of the week. As far as my counselors here, we are supposed to have another meeting at 4 o'clock. I am going to put on the table that we take the next 15 minutes and have our meeting where we just take the next 15 minutes to go over the schedule of which we've produced. That's all of that. Our usual meeting is just about who's doing what over the course of the week. We have it here. Are there any objections to me giving you back an hour at 4 o'clock? Okay. Yes. Is there an FOI follow-up while I hand these out?
No.
Well, there's a surprising number of us hanging around, so.
We have a high-level commission official from Barclays Austin.
Yeah. I didn't know she was Canadian. Okay, well, we'll invite her. So what you have in front of you is a schedule of what we believe are the relevant events that we should have some coverage or participation in. It's done by day, listing the time, location, and title of the session, and where appropriate, have already put in at least a name or two that we know will be covering the event. Sure. There you go. Thank you, Bart. And I would say the purpose of this is twofold, which is to pencil in names where there are blank spaces to make sure the CC community or the CCNSO council is covered in some way, shape, or form at the specific sessions, and or if we've missed anything that you think is also relevant that we should be participating in. So trying to cover this in a timely manner, I thought we would just go do a page flip day by day, and where there is an empty box in the attendance or main lead, try to fill that in. And I would suggest that those, obviously if it's necessary, if it's not necessary, we don't have to cover it. The first is today at 5:30, which is the stewardship transition. I mean, we will have CC members there, obviously, as co-chairs, and I think there was certainly interest in that. But is there anybody else from this group who would be going to that session at 5:30 to 7? Young Am? Carolina? All right. At the very least. Anybody else is welcome to go, but just making sure that we have some coverage there. And can provide feedback at the council meeting later in the week. Yeah, if necessary. Opening ceremony. I'll be there. Presumably most of us will be there. Pardon me? With the GNSO, yes. Yeah. I did send out an email. Jonathan and I went... We went back and forth and back and forth, and because of the shifting timelines and all the CWGC, we could not make it work, and it was going to get compressed down to a completely unreasonable time. And I did send an email, but only very recently. Responses to the ICG RFP, one would assume Keith will be there. Okay, so from a reporting back to us perspective, we're covered on that. Anybody else, of course, is welcome to go. SOAC high interest topics, I will be there for sure and can report back. I'm participating in it. CCWG accountability, our members will be there. Again, part of the reason this is here is just to make sure that we are all informed about what we think the most relevant topics are. So part of it's just so you have it and at hand. AOC organizational review, that's Monday at 3:30. AOC review. Jordy, you want to cover that? Thank you. The budget working group, we've nominated Roloff. We're voluntelling him. Okay. That's a placeholder. The SOP is meeting at 2:30 today, so somebody at least from the SOP will cover that. CCNSO ALAC meeting very early on Tuesday morning. I will be there. I think we should invite Giovanni because the SOP work is on the agenda. Meeting with the board, we will presumably all be there. So I think that's well covered. For Liz? Mm-hmm. Too bad we didn't ask her while she was here, but we'll ask her in the interim. And the meeting with the GAC, I would imagine, Keith, that you will be item number one and most of it. But we will also ask Giovanni and Annabeth to come because those are items on the agenda. Moving on to Wednesday. There's a CCWG accountability session, so we have many members there. So we're covered, but this is more to let the rest of you know that's happening. And there's a GAC panel discussion on geographic working names, on the geographic names working group, rather, and Annabeth is covering that for us. Yeah, she's on the panel itself. And CWG stewardship, all our members, well, hopefully all our members will be there. Moving to Thursday, the 12th, CCWG accountability working session. Again, our members are there, but it's an early morning session on Thursday. For those of you who want to participate or observe, ICANN planning and finance update, Thursday morning, we will get some SOP coverage on that. And there's an Internet Governance public session at midday. And I'm wondering, oh, Jordan's gone. We're going to ask, as our man on the IG, CWG, we'll ask Jordan to cover that. And that is it. Have I missed anything? Peter?
I think the answer to that question is no, but I missed something when we were walking through it. I forgot to ask. With the meeting with the board, one of the things, and I'm not sure if there would be time, and it's not a priority, but there is still a lot of confusion on ICANN's stance on internet governance and the Net Mundial initiative in particular. The Net Mundial initiative in particular. So it would be interesting to hear where the board is on that. Some say it's just a CEO project. Others say it's part of ICANN's strategy to keep on being involved in internet governance, but on a wider platform. I mean, I don't think there's a good or a bad thing there. I think, where are they? Yeah.
I think that's a good and relevant question because, you know, what is it? Is it an institutional interest or is it an individual interest? So that would be good to unpack that. Okay. Any other questions? Mrs.? Okay. Well, thank you very much for being here for 4 hours on a Sunday over lunch, but without lunch. Much appreciated. Thank you for your commitment. And you have an hour back in your life now at 4 o'clock.